Good. So today's September 21st, 2016. I'm Rick Hansen. And as you probably know, we're taking this year to explore the Buddha's really fundamental teaching of practice, mindfulness, the foundations of mindfulness. It's not the entirety of practice. It's the eightfold path, not the onefold path. Contra, you know, some people's opinions, I think sometimes, you know, there's a whole of practice, but still the foundations of mindfulness are really central. And what that means is really the establishments of mindfulness or the placing of mindfulness. What are we mindful of? So the way he lays it out is very practical. We start with mindfulness of the body. We become more in touch with ourselves, in touch with ourselves in all kinds of conditions, standing, sitting, walking, lying down, talking, driving, using the bathroom, jumping up and down, playing man monster gun, you know, in summer camp, something like that. You're in touch with the body. And then you become, in the second foundation of mindfulness, more and more aware of what has been traditionally translated as the feeling tone of experience. Modern psychology would translate it as more the hedonic tone of experience, as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And I might add, particularly given how social we are, the sense of things as heartfelt, not just pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But we'll stick with the traditional teaching right now. So as we tune more into the sense of things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, we become more aware in real time of that fundamental primal trigger that is so motivating for our ancient ancestors to resist what's unpleasant, chase what's pleasant, and want what's neutral to hurry up and get happy. All right? All right? That's the process. We're tuning into it. And that hedonic tone is a really efficient way to get lizards or jellyfish to swim away or fight with if they have to, what's unpleasant, you know, to eat or mate with what's pleasant. And if it's just neutral, keep swimming, okay? I find for myself, it's actually really haunting to ground our mindfulness practice in the recognition that certainly as far as our bodies are concerned, the ongoing construction of our experience is very shaped by the solution to survival problems faced by our ancestors, certainly during the 600 million year evolution of the nervous system. And lately I've started reading some things that are scientifically known that are really quite haunting, which is that human beings, as an animal species, have very little genetic diversity compared to many other species, particularly other primate species, other mammalian species. And that's because at some point in our long journey, particularly the steps of the journey between 195,000 years ago or so, when the first modern humans arose, anatomically modern humans, modern skeletons, modern skulls, arose in Africa about 195,000 years ago. Somewhere between that point and around 125,000 or so years ago, so somewhere during a 70,000 year window, the number of humans who were alive and capable of having children shrank to just several hundred, literally, which really meant that the human species shrank to roughly 1,000 or so members. We were nearly extinct. And that had to do with major cycles of climate change, made it harder and harder for people to stay alive. So our ancestors lived in little islands where they got lucky, and it was possible easily to get enough food to eat, relatively speaking. And they persisted, and we are their great-grandchildren today. So just imagine that process, these long processes that have shaped us. And we've inherited the results, for better or worse, you know, of what it took for our ancestors to stay alive and pass on genes that passed on genes. I find all that really quite haunting and remarkable, including if you really feel into how long these periods of time are. You know, that somewhere in that 70,000 year window, it sounds so easy to say it, but what is that? That's like 700 centuries. You know, 1,500 or so lifetimes, average lifespan, let's say, of about 50. Somewhere during that time, our ancestors shrank to a few thousand, perhaps even a few hundred people. Wow. So I don't know if that's that relevant to the foundations of mindfulness, but somehow it seems relevant to me in a kind of a haunting way, you know? So then we have the third foundation of mindfulness. We're in touch with the body, we're in touch altogether, and then we're tracking the hedonic tone of experience, this primal signal, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, and then what? And then in the third foundation of mindfulness, we move into the and then what, okay? And we're simply to be mindful of, to recognize what happens after it's unpleasant. Is there hatred, in a traditional term, resistance, aversion, or is there something else, like peace or calm strength or acceptance of what's unpleasant? If it's pleasant, then what? In the third foundation of mindfulness, is there grasping, chasing, clinging, addiction, drivenness, right, possessiveness, or something else? Just recognizing something else like contentment, fullness already, gratitude, aspiration without attachment. Okay? And if it's neutral, do we become deluded, confused, dissociated? Do we spin out into our little inner movies, the simulator, you know, where we go into our little fantasies, our reveries, you know, the default mode network, as it were, that stuff? Or not? Instead of being deluded, are we clear? Are we present? Can we stay, you know, insightful, even if it's not very stimulating, especially given our ADD culture? Right? We're recognizing. And fourth, in terms of the ordinary recognitions in the third foundation of mindfulness, and there are these sort of extraordinary states to recognize, but I'll get to that another evening. And then fourth, do we have a mind that is distracted, scattered, chasing one thing after another? You know, there's a metaphor that the mind is essentially like a monkey in a tall tower with six windows, sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, and internal mind objects. And this inner monkey is darting. This is monkey mind darting from window to window to window, right? Are we distracted or are we composed? Stable, is there steadiness of mind, sustained presence of mind? Which is, in a funny kind of way, the foundation of the other three recognitions, right? Okay, so that's the fundamental practice. And you can, so it follows on from being in touch with the body, because it's the body that's responding and producing the hedonic tone, the feeling tone of experience. And then what, right? Is that okay so far? So I want to talk about three things related to this, having kind of set that stage. Last week I talked about bringing a quality of playfulness to this process. It can be so drearily serious to practice, and there's a really important place for play and a playful spirit when we recognize these various things. So the first thing is, can we move more and more into real time in this recognition. In the very beginning, it often starts that we do it kind of with instant replay. We look back. We realize that for the last 5 minutes or 5 hours, 5 years, we've been holding on to some case or resentment or grievance, or perhaps we've been criticizing ourselves, beating ourselves up about something. We look back and we see it. But more and more, we start moving into real time. And that's where meditative practice is so helpful. It helps us move right into real time so we can start to see the emergence. In the face of what's unpleasant, what emerges? Are we tipping into anger and fear or helplessness, aversion? Or are we tipping into acceptance, peacefulness, sense of perspective, holding it in a bigger picture, calm strength, right? You start getting closer and closer to real time. So that's the first of the three kind of points I want to offer to you tonight, is to try to help yourself come closer and closer into real time in the responses to the feeling tones, the hedonic tones of experience. And there are a variety of things that help us do that. Having some kind of regular practice helps us do that. We kind of reset. It helps to have many little moments in the day where we kind of pause for a second and take a look what's going on inside. I have a friend, she has a little thing on her smartphone. We were just hanging out, having dinner basically with her and some other people. And about every 20 minutes, her phone would make this really beautiful sound, kind of like this bell, you know, ding. And we'd like, it's like a reset for us all, and, you know. And we're all pretty fairly conscious around the table. Didn't matter, bing, you know, came right back to, you know, present moment. Thich Nhat Hanh, I think, talks about using the telephone ringing sound. You know, it's like the sound of a temple bell. Or every time you walk through a doorway, that's another traditional practice, to kind of come, what's going on? This practice is just about recognition. That's not the entirety of the path, but this practice in the third foundation of mindfulness isn't about wise effort. We're not trying to nudge anything one way or another, but we are trying to get closer and closer to the present moment of recognition. Okay? That's the first kind of suggestion about it. And to help yourself do that more and more and more so that becomes your own habit. You start noticing stuff that's arising. And it often also helps to label it. Irritation, crankiness, you know. I distinguish myself between irritability and irritation. You know, like irritability, you're not irritated yet, right? You know, you can go there. You know, body's in pain, hungry, sleepy, you know, rattled, hurt, irritated, haunted, you know, primed in some ways. You know, maybe primed to anger. You're not angry yet, but you're primed to it. Heavy-hearted, you know. There was a time after my father died about 10 months ago where people would ask me, how am I doing? I'd say, well, I have a very heavy heart, awash in well-being. You know, it felt like a spaciousness of well-being in which there was a very heavy heart. You know, so that's true. That's what's there. And a heavy heart can kind of prime us for certain things. So what's going on? You get more and more in real time. Okay. Second suggestion, I'm going to use a kind of funny metaphor here. I think about the surface of a glass of soda water fizzing away. So imagine a clear glass of really, really fizzy soda water. Right? And then imagine slow motion movie of the surface of the glass. So now the surface is consciousness. It's this moment. And if you look down at the glass, you can see in real time bubbles emerging, starting to form, maybe even interacting with each other, you know, in tenths of a second or hundreds or even thousands of a second. And then they pop, little ripples spread out that interact with other bubbles starting to form, affecting them. Pop, 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 pop. That's like the surface of the mind. All these things are bubbling up continuously. Sensations, sounds, sights, reactions. You know, bubbles reacting to bubbles reacting to bubbles. Okay? And then, so now you're kind of watching it happen. And to use my kind of weird metaphor here, often we catch ourselves retrospectively. You know how, like, if you have a glass of really fizzy soda water, if you're 3 or 4 or 5 inches away from it, you kind of sniff it, you can smell it, so you're up here. And that's kind of like how it often is. You know, we're noticing something that actually popped into awareness a few seconds or minutes ago. But now we kind of notice it up here. So what we're doing is we're getting closer and closer to real time, to the emergence into awareness of what's happening. And we even start tracking a little bit. We start getting an intuition of what's almost semi-conscious or pre-conscious, just starting to come into being. And as we get closer and closer to that real-time recognition, often our recognition changes the bubble. Oh, irritation. So we note it. Maybe we add a word to it, which technically increases activation in the prefrontal cortex and calms down the alarm bell of the brain, the amygdala, just simply noting, hurt, oh, heavy-hearted, oh, sad, back is killing me. Why hasn't my son called me back? Right? You're closer. And just the recognition of that sort of nudges the bubble in a different direction, which is interesting because it implies that our resting state is more peaceful and contented and loving if just recognition alone resets us back to the green zone, as it were, kind of brings us home. Isn't that interesting? Just recognizing usually doesn't make us more neurotic, more cranky, you know, more hateful, more resentful, more irritated, more ashamed, more blue. Recognition actually centers us because that's our resting state. That's our true home base. That's our true underlying nature. Okay. So now, as you get closer and closer to the surface in real time of all these bubbles, pop, 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 your awareness starts to expand to include the whole glass. Starts to expand to include the whole of mind. The whole of mind. You start dropping down into being you, you in the broadest sense, the person, process, locally unfolding, right? As this surface instantaneously of the water, the mind right here, including awareness itself, including subjectivity, nothing excluded, nothing left out, all of it included as a single whole process. The surface of the glass at any moment continuously. And often we have that sense in meditation. We come down into the whole. We're resisting nothing, holding on to nothing. We're right at the front edge of now, just now, just now. Whoosh. Gone so fast, and just being all of it. Often we'll have a sense of that for a part of a second, and then we notice it, and we're no longer the whole, we're the part commenting on the whole, right? Or part commenting on another part, or a part wanting to be back as the whole. And then we relax some more, and eventually we kind of come back into the whole. And a funny little metaphor that's been working for me, and feel free to find your own, is this notion that at the surface of the glass, all these little waves are popping up. You know, like the surface of the sea, this little reaction, this that little reaction, this perspective, that view. Or you could kind of broaden it out. You know, this idea I have about your idea, about my ideas, you know. Or you could even take it further, sort of reality altogether. You know, there's this kind of wave here, there's that wave there, you know, right? So all the waves, and you, in the ocean, there are all these waves, right? And each wave is unique, individual, but really, there's just the ocean, right? The wave is just a local expression of the ocean. And what starts to happen, and it's an opportunity in practice, as we come down closer and closer to real time, mind as a whole, the mind process, mind as a verb, minding, proceeding without a cause, without a single cause, without a single director, screenwriter for the movie, and even without a particular owner, if you will, simply, you know, contents of consciousness and consciousness itself unfolding. And when people have a sense of that and then deepen in the sense of that, often it's kind of ecstatic. It's weirdly joyful. It's peaceful. You know, like my own internal saying with this funny little metaphor of wave and ocean is, love the wave, be the ocean. Right? What are we most identified with? And when you do that, when you just go, yeah, it's another wave. This political force coming this way. It doesn't mean to deny how problematic a tidal wave can be and to recognize wave here, wave there. Really, it's an ocean of allness expressing itself locally in a variety of ways. And you see for yourself if that's a useful experience. Very often what that brings is profound peacefulness and weirdly capacity to deal with problematic waves but from a much more inclusive and wise place. There's not a problem. The ocean never has a problem. Okay. And then, stepping out of this pure awareness practice that is the essence of the third foundation, it's not itself making any kind of effort. then there is the possibility that I want to invite you into, over time, as you recognize different kinds of waves, you know, waves of anger, waves of peace, waves of fear, waves of calm strength, you know, waves of chasing, waves of contentment and gratitude already, you know. As you do that, and especially it's supported by dropping more and more into this ocean reality, it's the truth of things. It is the truth of things. Can you help yourself be called home? In other words, when you recognize, you know, anger or calm strength, right? Resentment or compassion, distractibility or composure, chasing some addiction or feeling full and happy and just fine already, right? Can you help yourself be drawn toward the wholesome alternative? You know, can you help yourself be increasingly sensitized to and inclined toward, you know, love instead of hate, right? Peace instead of anger, contentment instead of drivenness or possessiveness, right? Can you help yourself be more and more drawn toward the whole instead of the part? And a way to do that is, in some ways, to help yourself fall in love with or feel the reward of that which feels most beautiful, true, healthy, wise, and tip. Help yourself tip increasingly toward that. Recognize the goodness of it, recognize the fruit of it, realize that's really the greater happiness. One of my favorite sayings from the Buddha Dharma is, wisdom is choosing a greater happiness over a lesser one. It's helping yourself appreciate that this is a greater happiness. There is a certain pleasure in righteously making your case. I know that pleasure well. There is a certain pleasure, right, in getting hammered. I know that pleasure well. There is a certain pleasure in, chasing some pleasure, getting really, really into it. I know that pleasure well. But, you know, is it the greater happiness? Right? It's usually not the greater happiness. And over time, we can help ourselves really appreciate and feel the rewards of and recognize the goodness of and help it really sink in when we choose a greater happiness over a lesser one. We can't do that if we're not recognizing closer and closer to real time what's actually going on. And if you can be everything always continuously, that's great. But if you're still engaging this wave or that wave, to help yourself be drawn toward the waves that are most wholesome is certainly a very, very useful thing to do over time. Yeah. Okay. So, third foundation of mindfulness, right? Any comments or nightmare scenarios or questions? What do you think? Do you see the first, be in touch with yourself, first foundation, second foundation, tracking the hedonic tone of experience. Third foundation, general qualities of mind, recognizing them. And in the recognition, as closer and closer to real time as you can get, you know, naturally coming home to who you really are. And then also, if you like, helping yourself be increasingly drawn toward, you know, that which really calls you home. Great. Oh, yeah, great. Good. Thanks, Ed. Thanks, Beth. Yeah, please.
You speak about my choosing the greater happiness.
Yeah.
That's pretty difficult when there's a tidal wave.
Yeah, that's right.
So can you help me?
That's great. So how do you choose the greater happiness when you're plugged in?
Right.
That's the expression we use. You know, it's like fingers in the wall socket. Yeah. You know,
exactly.
Donald Trump's face is on the television, or whatever your deal is, you know what I mean? You know, so what do you do? Minimally, and it's great, the teaching of the Buddha is be aware in your body. What's going on in the body? You know, the heart's starting to beat,
yeah.
The face is contracting, the shoulders are tenser, yeah. You know, the arms are starting to come up, whatever, or maybe there's a freeze response, or. You know, you can just feel it inside. I mean, I saw myself in the body being my father when our children were little That was horrifying. I mean, he was a pretty good guy, but it was, I was channeling him at not one of his better moments, and wasn't one of my better moments either. So number one, in the body. Number two, what is the feeling tone? What's unpleasant? You're probably describing an unpleasant tidal wave. You know, not so much, not chasing a problematic pleasure, but reacting to something that's unpleasant. Just tracking that. What's unpleasant about this? Why is it unpleasant? Is it the way I'm looking at things that make it unpleasant? The Buddha makes this great distinction, as you probably know, between the first dart and the second dart of life. First darts are inherently unpleasant, including the social first dart of someone who's been wounding, right? In that moment, it's going to be unpleasant. Ultimately, over time, maybe we can help ourselves become less rattled by that sort of thing. But in the moment, it is. You drop a brick on your foot, it's going to be unpleasant, right? If someone attacks something that you hold near and dear to your heart, and it goes to our political season right now, you know there can be a natural unpleasantness that arises. But then, do we add second, third, fourth, fifth darts ourselves? Do we add to it? Do we catastrophize around it? Do we make it very global? Do we turn a passing thing into something permanent? Do we lose sight of the bigger perspective? You know, do we isolate, as the brain is wont to do, on that one tile in the mosaic of reality, or our, including our inner experience, including the sensations in the body, that's flashing red, and we did it. So that, right there. And then third foundation of mindfulness is, can we simply recognize what's hijacking us, what's taking us? And a lot of practice, honestly, I think, is just ride out the storm. That's all you can do. First dart or second dart, you know, in the moment that a second dart has arisen, can you ride out that storm without throwing a third dart? If you throw the third dart, can you stop there? You know? And so that's very, very important practice. I mean, one of the best practices for me is to keep my mouth shut. You know, I mean, sometimes people err because they don't speak up, but very often they err, you know. So, you know, my wife will do something. Who knew? And a reaction will arise. And I've really tried, also some psychological understanding of yourself, like, wow, that's so turbocharged by my childhood. You start recognizing some of the usual preamps, the usual suspects. These are like the preamps, right? What happened is like a one or a two on the 10-point scale of they really are a jerk. Not that my wife would ever be really a jerk, but anyway. So something happens, all right? But then it hits this preamp from your childhood, your history, your last relationship, whatever, the kids in school, and whoing, it gets cranked up. So we start to recognize that more in real time. You know, and just we write it out. We don't add insult to injury. Like that's so much of it, I think, so much of it. And then in my personal experience, there's often a natural trajectory where time goes this way. We get triggered, right? Somewhere on the run-up, we start to notice we're triggered. The closer we can get to the launch, to ignition, the better. You know, the closer to real time, then we're triggered. And, you know, truthfully, maybe we spew, we leak, like, stuff happens. We grumble, we stamp our feet, we, something. Maybe we beat ourselves up. Maybe we do something. All right, but fairly quickly, ideally, we kind of get a grip on that problematic, you know, discharging or acting out, we would say in psychotherapy, and kind of, and then we start communicating about it, hopefully, and then come down to a soft landing. That's really, for me, the fundamental matter. You know, can you catch yourself faster, pour less gasoline on the fire, and more rapidly come to a softer landing? And then also repair, if there's a repair to be made. And try to learn from the experience. So the next time it happens, you're a little less likely to ignite in the first place. Or if you do ignite, ignition, you get triggered. All right, so be it. It's natural for us to get triggered. Being triggered is a survival adaptation. We're designed to be triggerable. Okay, it's not your fault, right? But then you catch that you're triggered 1 second faster, and then you get, you know, 10% better, 1% better at not pouring gas on the fire, and then you come to a softer landing a few minutes sooner, and you repair a little more gracefully, then you learn from the experience, and then you get better at it the next time. And I think of this great saying from, for me, Upandita, Southeast Asian teacher, says the purpose of practice is to expand the range of experiences in which we're free. So that stuff happens, but more and more, it doesn't rattle us. Or it doesn't rattle us quite so much. And over time, it doesn't rattle us at all. You know, and we also, if we're up for it, explore these ultimate practices. As soon as you drop into being everything, nothing is a problem. This side of a full enlightenment, it's hard to stay there. Yeah, I can't stay there. There are people who, in my view, they're just there all the time. They really are. It's an uncommon achievement. There are more Olympic athletes who win gold medals than are fully enlightened people, I think, on the planet. But moments of awakening many times a day, right? And then more and more and more that sense of being everything in which nothing is a problem. You respond with love. You don't just let it, you know, go by. But you're not upset about it. You're not pierced to your core by it. You're not adding insult to injury. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, great, in the back.
I was wondering, you mentioned about anger and irritation and how if you identify it and name it, it can cause the amygdala to sort of calm down. Can you talk about how that happens?
It's really interesting. It's a very, now when you're naming it, you're not channeling your inner Woody Allen. Or some, you know, very new age, I don't know what. So, that, you know, it's short and sweet. It's like, oh, pain. Oh, sadness. Oh, you know, or there might just be an image. Like I'll see myself as a young boy in school, picked last for some sports team. I was very young and scrawny as well, going through school. Or I'll just feel like that's what that is. Oh, that. It's kind of like that. Oh, that. Mindfulness practices are recognition practices. It's not the whole of the path, but it's profoundly powerful to recognize it. And why that is, basically, probably it involves some kind of prefrontal insight or understanding that exercises inhibitory control over these more ancient subcortical regions, like the amygdala, that evolved 200 or so million years ago. They're old, you know. And it's not, by the way, that the cortex is the really good part of the brain, and these more ancient parts are the bad parts of the brain. Because the cortex can be full of some seriously whack ideas, right? And these more ancient parts of the brain have a lot of warm-heartedness and sweetness and sociality to them, community to them. But to be able to just simply note it, and it's not adding, oh, I'm such a schmuck because I'm irritated at my wife. It's not adding any crap. It's just noting. What is it? What is it? Including as you can have access to it, the deeper layers involved. Yeah. And in that process, you start to, in a sense, identify more with the labeler than what is labeled, which defuels it right off the top. You're shooting less energy into it. You're starting getting more spaciousness around it. Yeah. Great. In the back, Sylvia.
So my question here is, in order to stay, because we all know nirvana is not the lower, and you don't really reach nirvana, you just don't have ignorance, anger, and all that, you know, go to that lower part. However, I'm not going to go into the past body and the present and the consciousness, but if you continually stay in consciousness, then pretty much you're always aware, but you just have to be so in tune with staying there that you don't have the other symptoms. I guess what I'm trying to say is, be clear on what I'm trying to say. In other words, when Buddha, version 131, when Buddha went all over the place because he was aware of everybody and everybody was one, they were saying that Thera was meditating, but she was meditating alone, and Buddha called her up and said, well, I don't have a problem with you meditating alone. However, by you being disassociated, because you want to stay present in your practice, you're actually leaving everybody out. He says, what I'd like you to do is be present, but aware, but because I'm trying to do things that, you know, with this group that I'm involved with, that, that I do quite a lot of the stuff in Nepal, but they're elderly women that are in their 80s, but staying present because being aware of what I'd like to do, but in the meantime, including, you know, everybody, but I don't have to go back into the past and, you know, grasp and stuff.
Thank you.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is, in order to stay present, just be aware that you have that nice feeling with everybody involved, right?
I think that's beautiful, and it's funny, the more we kind of come into being more like the ocean, you know, or just in the moment, you start realizing that we're all practicing together. In other words, what's happening here is the result of others, you know, others in the present, others in our past, you know, and we start realizing also that our practice is in relationship to other people. We practice for the sake of others. That's been a really beautiful piece of this journey for myself, to realize that, you know, I'm practicing in part for the sake of others, if not fully for the sake of others. You know, it's a very lovely thing. So I appreciate, Sylvia, you saying that. And one thing that's interesting too is that, to begin to be clear, I think it can be neat to read about amazing beings, and it's kind of cool, but a little bit it has this quality of reading about X-Men or superheroes somewhere. Like, wow, far out, you know what I mean? Yeah. And then the question for me becomes, all right, past the part that's kind of far out or maybe inspiring, how do we reverse engineer what's going on with them? How do we take it seriously? And one of the things I personally really appreciate about, as best we can tell, the Buddha's teachings, is he made them accessible for everybody. And he invited everybody along the way. Obviously, there are distinctions in terms of stages of practice. People who are, you can look back and you can go, wow, I've really come a ways. And you can look forward and see people who are farther up the path, you know. But it's a whole path. And then we try to bring into the present some qualities that we can see in other people, particularly the next step. And I find that myself really useful. What are some fundamental qualities of people who are awakened? They seem very in the present. They're not attached to things. And they're very loving, you know. And you might even say, as I think is my own, you know, experience and belief, that when you come more and more into the ocean, as it were, kind of at the leading edge of now, the emergent edge of now, the front edge of now, it's really interesting. What are the qualities of that something or other you're dropping into, or you feel like is always just prior to, you know, what's emergent? And it feels very, very peaceful. It can be almost ecstatic and blissful. And it has this kind of loving, benevolent consciousness to it. Like, what up with that? I'll leave you with the comment of a friend of mine who I've talked about before, practiced as a monk in Asia for 9.5 years. He's now a massage therapist in North Dakota. I can give you his card if you're ever going to Grand Forks or Grand Rapids, whatever it's called. Anyway, Patrick. And I asked him about, did he meet anyone who was enlightened? You know, these people who are less common even than gold medal winners in the Olympics, but I think still really real. He said, yeah, certainly a few, certainly a few. What were they like, I asked. He said, well, they were always the same. If you were nice to them, they really loved you. If you were mean to them, they really loved you. Their love was so established that it was undisturbed. They would be practical. They would respond in practical ways, but they never lost their own center. And I think as well of a true story of a Tibetan monk who was caught in, ended up in, I want to make some clear distinctions here, I'll say Chinese government jails in Tibet, where he was routinely tortured for many years. And finally, he was released. And he told the Dalai Lama a true story about all these terrible things that had happened to him. And at one point, the Dalai Lama burst out and said, weren't you afraid for your life at some point? And he said, well, I was only afraid for my life when I started to feel like I was losing my loving kindness, my metta, for the people who were torturing me. That was his real life. As he, you know, that's someone who's very far along, right? Okay. So how about we just sit and reflect on this a little bit, including this third foundation of recognitions, for 1 minute.